The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But Dacrell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 178.
All roads lead to Exilium with Emma Newman.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
And obviously our special guest today is Emma Newman. Hello, Emma.
Hello.
So this is the second time you've been, this is the third time you've been on the show.
Three main weapons, yes. Third time.
Because you were on an episode with, was it Stephanie Salter?
I was on the one with Susan, whatever Susan, that's her
Bigelow.
Twitter handle.
Oh, Bigelow, yes. Susan.
Okay, so, yep, and then you were on Worldcon episode, which at the time of this recording had, it will drop it in 4 hours. And now you're on this one, which is a proper interview where we're going to actually dig into the work and ask you very hard questions.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's going to be very terrifying. So that's not true. But I want to start off with the kind of the only real stock question we have on here now, which is instead of asking you why you read or like genre fiction, I actually want to ask what keeps you coming back to genre fiction, and in this case we're talking like science fiction and fantasy, although there are other genres that are in your Split Worlds work. So what keeps you coming back?
Well, every time I'm forced to go elsewhere, I am left dissatisfied, mostly. That's the reason. We're in a local book club where I live, and the other people in the group keep kind of making us read contemporary literature and like contemporary lit, I suppose. And I find it deeply, deeply dissatisfying in the main. There just isn't enough to keep me engaged. And I want to go to other places and I want to explore the real things about this world through more interesting lenses. And I think the most interesting lenses are the ones you get in SFF.
Oh, that's interesting. So what is it about contemporary or I guess just like real world fiction that is so dissatisfying for you? Like, what is it that doesn't work?
I think, well, I mean, it may obviously, it's not all of it because I'm not so ridiculous as to suggest that I have read all of it because that's impossible. But certainly the things that I've come across, one of the things that I really don't like about it is not very much happens. And there's a lot of navel gazing and a lot of kind of analysis of other people and themselves. And I have that every damn day. That is like my head. And I don't really want to be in my own head when I read a book. It's not just an escapism thing. It's a wanting to look at things differently. And so many of the kind of the straight contemporary literature novels I've read, it's like reading my own thoughts in many cases, and it's like, no, I have to be here every bloody minute of the day. Oh, I'm sorry, is this am I allowed to swear in a minor fashion?
Be totally honest, the word bloody is really not qualified as a
minor
swear world anymore.
Oh, that's
maybe
all right,
at least
then.
Not here in the US.
Are we allowed to swear? Because I have my non, oh, thank fuck for that. It's just awful. I enjoy swearing immensely. I apologize to any listeners who do not.
We have explicit tag, so as long as every other word out of your mouth isn't a swear word, I think we're good.
So that's the main reason, yeah. I just want to get away from that kind of thing. It may be that I have been introduced to entirely the wrong things. But yeah, I think with SFF, there's just so much variety, and there are so many good writers, so many wonderful books and amazing worlds that, you know, there are so many things that I want to read that are on my to-be-read pile, as everybody that I know in these circles knows well. There's just so much to read. I don't feel I ever need to leave this wonderful place.
Well, and on your Skype image, you actually have a John Wyndham novel.
Yes, my favorite John Wyndham novel, no less.
The Kraken Wakes. I can't tell which title. Oh, okay. All right.
And yeah, it's The Kraken Wakes.
The only one I've read is The Day of the Triffids.
Yeah, which I do adore. And The Kraken Wakes is one that a lot of people haven't read. Most of the time, people have read The Day of the Triffids or The Chrysalids. And especially in the UK, I think The Chrysalids was a school text for some time. So there's a certain kind of generation of people who all read it as a child. But The Kraken Wakes is wonderful. It's a really menacing, slow burn. And it's truly horrifying at certain points. And I love it. And it's all focused around the sea as well. And I have a huge fondness for the sea. And the way that he makes it terrifying really appeals to me.
Paul?
Yeah. Yeah. You were talking about how you enjoy swimming in the sea of genre and feeling that, never feeling having to leave it. How do you feel then about books which are only tangentially genre, or where the author himself says, no, this is not a genre book, like, say, Margaret Atwood? Do you consider those genre for purposes of your own consumption?
Yes. I mean, I find it endlessly fascinating that she says that she does not write science fiction, and the reasons why. And I have... There are so many times when I've talked to people who are not in my tribe, effectively, and I say that I write science fiction and fantasy, and they give me that look and say, I don't read that sort of thing. And that kind of snobbery really upsets me. I'm struggling to think of many novels I've read which have purported not to be genre. Can you give me any other examples?
I've gone blank. Ben Okri gets particularly annoyed when people call his work magical realism or fantasy.
No, I haven't read any of his. I mean, I don't know. Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell was kind of not marketed as fantasy over here at all. It was kind of very much in the kind of, ooh, isn't this a quirky novel, the likes of which have never existed before? Yeah, but seemed they were marketing to the mainstream, but it was... Yeah. To me, so obviously a genre novel.
But I don't think they ever disavowed being known as writing genre. I can't think of many examples where somebody is like vehemently, at least not anymore. I mean, Atwood has said it in the past, but she's really softened on that since she's, I think it's become more clear that, she's been influenced by a lot of science fiction, and she admits it. She's read a great deal of it, and she actually considers herself a fan. And so her perspective seems to have changed somewhat. She still doesn't want to call her work science fiction. She still sticks to this speculative fiction thing, which it just seems like it's splitting hairs, like, oh, whatever.
Exactly. But... Yeah, I don't really mind. I mean, I've heard the expression, the kind of the science fiction and fantasy ghetto, and that, you know, once you're in it and considered to be that kind of writer, that you never leave it. And I just, you know, throw my hands in the air and say, well, so what? I don't care. I love it here. All of my friends are here and they write fabulous books. And if other people have a problem with saying that they write the kind of stuff that we write and love, well, then they can go off and be miserable in their own little corner of the world. It's a big place. There are lots of people who are very happy here. They can all just get on with it over there.
It's also just
a nice cup of tea.
Ooh. Well, I do have PG tips.
Oh, I like PG tips.
I have two boxes of 240 each. So I have a lot of PG tips in my apartment.
Is that because someone sent them to you or brought them over, or can you buy them in the States now? Because I've heard tales of people taking over suitcases full of tea for friends who can't buy tea in the US, and it's such horror stories.
Well, I think PG tips now, because I don't think the stuff I bought was imported. I think they now have an American... office. I mean, the tea itself is probably imported. They probably still get the tea leaves from, like, India or wherever they get the tea leaves from. But they have an American branch now.
I would find that very stressful if I knew that these were kind of like rare boxes, and I would be kind of counting them down every day to make sure I would never run out. That would be awful.
Which is why buying in bulk is always a great idea.
Yeah, I mean, I buy in bulk and I live here and it's readily available everywhere. I mean, I'm sure that would be the best way to kind of invade and take over Britain would just be to cut off the tea supply, and we'd all be like killing each other.
Where's our tea?
4 days. Yeah, that's all you need to do. Deprive us of caffeine and tannin, and that's it.
Except like most of the people I know from England, like with the exception of yourself, every time I'm like, oh, I love tea, and they're like, oh, I hate tea, and I'm really shocked because the stereotype is British people just like they're born like with tea.
I know, and it's something I acquired late. When I was a teenager, I'd only drink coffee. I didn't like tea, and it's something I've grown to love. I'm a terrible stereotype.
It's okay.
I don't mind.
It fulfills a need for us Americans. It's good. We need the stereotypes. So to kind of go back, one of the other questions I had that was actually related to this question is it's been very interesting that in the last, well, this year alone, we've interviewed two people who've included the Fae, sort of broadly speaking, in their work very explicitly. And we have interviewed Stina Light, whose work does include the Fae, although she hasn't released a book this year that's set in that world. She's working on something else. And I was really curious that it seems like there's quite a lot of this stuff being written, whether in the YA field or in just sort of the general science fiction fantasy. So I'm curious for you, what is it that you find so interesting about the Fae, and why do you think that the fantasy genre continues to kind of go back to it?
It's funny, isn't it? Because when I was writing it, I had no idea that other... It's always the same whenever, like when all of the dystopian YA stuff came out, everyone was like, oh my God, look, everybody's been writing dystopian YA. You're all doing it at the same time. And it seems that everyone was like, yeah, I didn't know that everyone else was doing that, because the way publishing works is that nobody knows about the trends until the trend is happening. And because things are published a year to 2 years after you wrote them, it's impossible to, like, by the time you're aware of the trend and would want to write to fit into it, the trend is on the decline. It's kind of weird. And so I'm about to go to a convention, I think, where I'm on a panel about why the Fae are so popular, and I'm kind of surprised in a way. As for why I think it's there, I think the Fae, they are a very important part of our folklore and our mythology, and especially in the British Isles. In particular, the things that I love to do with the Fae is Irish mythology and the Sidhe. And they were a big influence on the kind of the conception of the Fae in my Split Worlds novels, because they're just so awful. Really, really horrible people who just, you know, willfully screw up people's lives left, right and center, and they don't give a shit about it. And I love that. So that's one of the kind of the main things. And I think that they're just everywhere. When you're growing up as a kid, there are fairy stories everywhere. There's obviously Grimm's and Hans Christian Andersen, where, you know, elements of it pop up in various guises. So I think it's something which is kind of woven into us deeply. So all of the things that we consume obviously come out in our work, and it's one of the things that come out in our work. I think the other thing with the Fae, the other influence, is actually playing vampire in the 90s as a role player. And that had a big influence on the way that the Fae are political in the Split Worlds novels, and the kind of the puppetry of mortals. And of course, you know, every man and his dog has written a vampire book in the last 10 years, and there's no way on earth I had anything to add to that. But, you know, with Fae, I thought, well, I can play with that aspect that I really like, but I can also play with the mythology that I love, and I can play with lots of other ideas, and kind of playing with tired fairy stuff like Three Wishes, the old trope of Three Wishes. And wanting to play with that myself and make it interesting for myself again. So I think there are various, those are the kind of the main reasons.
I particularly found that element, because like everybody thinks, oh, cute, funny, I get three wishes, I get to do cool stuff. And then you realize when the character grants these three wishes, it's actually a sadistic game.
Yes, absolutely. And that the children who grow up in nether society, I trained from a very young age how to deal with this, because it's like the worst thing that could possibly happen to you, to be granted three wishes by one of the Fae. Because, yeah, it is exactly that. It's designed to trip you up and to screw you up and potentially destroy you and your family. And I liked flipping it on its head.
Yeah, and that's actually something I was very interested about. Is in the Between Two Thorns in particular, one of the sort of main themes is actually the question of free will or free determination. Because the main character, or one of the main characters, because there's Max and
Sam and Will.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, and getting sort of stuck in this situation where you just can't escape. You have to make these wishes, and if you screw up, you lose everything. You lose yourself. That he just will, the Fae will just take it. Mm. And I was curious about what the kind of design for exploring this particular thematic throughout the story and the kinds of fears that are associated with it.
Where it came from, or
all of the above.
I mean, it's one of those things. When I sit down to write a novel, I don't decide to explore a particular theme. Themes are emergent. It's a bit like consciousness. It's an emergent property of the brain. And with the themes in the Split Worlds series, there's a lot of feminism, a huge amount of feminism, which is obviously tied into freedom and being able to determine your own life and your own path through life and things like that. But when I look back and look at characters like Max and Sam and Will, all of them are just as trapped in their own ways. And in particular, Will is a very critical part of the exploration of freedom and the patriarchy, and how a patriarchal society doesn't only screw over women, but it completely screws over men as well. And that I wanted to show both sides of it and how it's shit for both genders. And that Will has very little freedom, and he's a player. He can play the game in a way that Kathy never could and doesn't even want to. But even so, you know, he's still part of the system. He's still controlled. He still has very, very little freedom. So where did that kind of come from? Why did I explore it? I don't know. I guess it's a pretty universal theme. The feminism stuff, I got really angry over the past few years. I just got so royally fucked off with so many things. And I guess it just kind of all came out in the books.
What was it that, I mean, I can understand from our perspective, like in the United States, we have our own particular hellhole going on in terms of issues related to women. What is it that was, what set you off?
The media and the portrayal of women in the media in terms of advertising, television, film. And once I started to think about it, once I started to see it, it was like, oh my God, it is everywhere. And how did I not see this before? Yeah. Are things getting worse, or was I just not aware? And I think it's a combination of the two. And I think that my generation, I mean, it's a bit odd because like my mum is only in her 50s, but you know, she just kind of glided through the 70s when there were lots of people who have doing a lot of kind of building of awareness of feminism and things like that. And it feels like we kind of dropped the ball a little bit. We had kind of minor successes in the 80s and the 90s and shifting things, and very minor successes. And then it feels like it all kind of tailed off. And by the time I kind of entered my 30s, it was like, what? Did I just doze off or something? And then suddenly everything turned to shit. It's kind of scary. And I wonder if it's just also because I'm getting older and suddenly realizing how things are skewed towards youth and the perception of women at different stages of your life, and like the maiden, mother, crone thing going on and all that kind of stuff. I guess it was a lot of different factors, and also social media making me much, much more aware. And yeah, all the terrible stuff happening around the world.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that I feel like with a lot of issues, the way you grow up, you're sort of, I will hesitate to use the word indoctrinated, but what the hell, indoctrinated into a certain perspective of reality, of how the world functions. And then there are all these ways in which as you grow up and you get older, you sort of recognize that these things aren't, that's not how the world actually is, the way that you were taught it is. So like an example that isn't feminist, but is, well, I guess sort of kind of is feminist, but like the story of Pocahontas, right? The only story I was taught in school or by film was the Disney-fied version where like there's the John Smith and they're like, oh, I'm in love and I love you and I'm going to go get married, right? And like singing animals and, you know, the British people are just all evil, big, fat guys who just want gold, right? That's just basically it. That's the story. For some reason, John Smith's American, even though we're talking about British colonists. But it's this weirdest thing. But then when you start to look at the history and you actually look at how Disney, that film distorts the actual story, even bound down to very basic, simple facts, like the fact that she had nothing to do with John Smith. She married some other guy and all sorts of horrible things happened. But like that realization, when you sort of look at the history and then you try to watch that film again, you just realize you can't turn off your critic glasses anymore. You're just seeing all of the ways that this is trying to give a perception of reality that's actually kind of dangerous and bad. Because it paints a picture that's kind of actually horrifying.
Yeah, and I think also when I had a realization that all of my heroes were men, and I suddenly thought, hang on a minute, and started looking at film differently because film had a major influence on me as I was a teenager and growing up. I was a real film nerd. Special effects nerd as well. And when I started to look at it and think, well, hang on, where are the women in these films? Oh my God, we are just the fucking love interest or the trophy or the goal or the catalyst so that the hero will go and do something heroic or achieve something. And it's like, well, where the fuck are my heroes in my gender? And why are we always the same kind of functional bit of plot? We're just a device. And where is the range of personalities that I see in my female friends and in myself and the real women I look in the world? And then I suddenly go, well, hang on a minute. There are 52% of the world's population are women and there's like 5% in films. What the actual fuck is going on here?
Yeah.
And then I got really, really upset.
No,
I'm getting red here. I'm getting red and angry.
I totally understand because there've been attempts to change the way we look at history so that we're actually talking about not just the men but also the women who had influences, and they have all kinds of different influences. Women were inventing things, they were changing the social landscape, they were writing great books, they were doing all these things that a lot of them just got kind of ignored. Like one of the things that's just recently been changed, I don't know if everyone's familiar with Henrietta Lacks. I don't know the full story, but basically they took her genetic material and they've been using it in medical research because there's something specific about her genes that is, they've been calling it kind of like the immortal gene. They can just keep reproducing the cells.
Right, because of the strain of cancer she had.
Right, so it's this really remarkable scientific discovery, but only fairly recently have people been trying to point out, like, they're using this woman's genetic, she's been dead for a long time, she's passed away in, I think, 1951, I think. So she's been dead for quite a while, but they've had her material, and nobody was talking about the fact that this woman's material has had such an influence on medical history, and they're not talking about her. They're not talking about this woman. It's just sort of like they've reduced her to, you know, cells. And there was a book that was written on her recently about her and what we know about her. And now recently, what I think one of the companies that is using her material for, you know, like pharmaceutical or some sort of whatever that's going to influence our daily life, They're basically saying we're now going to be donating proceeds they were going to give the credit to her, something of that nature. But it's only by talking about her and talking about her history and her importance that we're actually getting to that point where we're recognizing her. And if you don't talk about her, it's almost like she doesn't exist.
Yeah, and also not only the fact that it's herself, but also all of the women who are responsible for scientific discoveries and huge leaps forward, and the women in science now who are doing amazing things that you just don't see or hear. And, I mean, and I think that is part of a wider problem in our kind of negative-focused media, which I have a huge problem with, that they seem intent on keeping us fearful and unhappy. and that there are lots of incredibly wonderful, positive things happening in the world, and totally shit and horrific things too. We need both. Yeah, exactly. And there are some amazing advances, and there are some women. I saw a scientist give a talk at the Clark Awards ceremony last year called Rachel Armstrong, who is now, I'm very happy to say, I have a female hero at last, because she was just so incredibly inspiring and is doing the most amazing stuff. And her work has inspired the book that I'm writing at the moment. And that made me very happy. But, you know, we need to know about this more. We need more coverage.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there definitely has to be a change in the discussion. But we don't get there by not talking about it, which is why it's good that we're talking about it.
Yeah.
About that problem. And then you can expose all of the douche nozzles out there who, we don't need to talk about lady folks. Like, well, thank you for letting us know you're an asshole. I don't have to deal with you anymore, jerkface. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Paul, you've had a hand up for a while, so why don't I let you jump in and we'll get back to the book.
Well, yeah, I was hoping to go back to the book. This was an interesting sidebar, but what the heck was I going to ask? Oh, I actually had a multi-piece sort of question, so I'll take it from one angle, Emma. So the three books are set in three different locales: Bath, London, and Oxford, as well as Ixilium and the Nether. I was just curious why you picked those three cities in particular for the three books.
Well, the first one, set in Bath, was partly because it was wandering around the city of Bath in the real world that kind of started the process of brewing the split worlds in the first place. I live about half an hour away from the city, so it's quite easy for me to visit. And all the various times when friends come to stay and relatives, it's like the place we take them for a day out. And I found myself, it's impossible when you go there because of the incredible architecture. And the wonderful locations like the assembly rooms, taking people around, it's impossible not to think about what it was like in the heyday and when it was at its peak. And it was the kind of the experience of walking around in two places or two times at once in one place, which I think was the root of the idea of having like the normal world Mundanus and having the Nether, where people are living in the same houses in terms of, you know, spatial location and time as well. But they're just outside of reality. They're just on the edge of it. And that there are people living two lives there at the same time. And that idea of walking around and imagining people in their finery and, you know, the bulls and things when we'd go to the assembly rooms, and having people like us, mundane people, wandering around, looking around. And I wanted both to exist at the same time. And so that kind of was, you know, effectively the Nether. As for the other locations, I wanted to grow. If when I built the world and was building the world with the short stories and the game I ran and all kinds of stuff, there were other locations. And I thought in terms of the reader that it would be better to anchor them into Aquaesulis and Bath. Initially, and then to grow the world with the movements of the characters, because I wanted to expand the political stage that the story played out on, which is why I kind of shifted the focus to Londinium and to London. And London as well has such a rich history that I wanted to bring in some of the other political elements that came with that history, like the story of the Tower of London and stuff like that. That played into that book. And then the third book, again, it was expanding the political stage. But also I lived in Oxford for many years. And it is just a really bizarre, magical place. It's kind of impossible to live there. We called it Toy Town when we lived there because it just felt like it was detached from everywhere else. It's a very odd and very wonderful place. And I know it quite intimately, so I wanted to explore it. And I also now I've got my little spoiler alert has popped up in my head. I've got a little icon flashing here. There's stuff to do with the way that Oxenford, which is the Nether reflection of Oxford, is organized and exists in the split worlds, which is kind of a commentary on the university I studied there, and I wanted to kind of play with some of the ideas and some of my experiences of the university there. So that's why that was brought in.
Well, that's interesting.
That is interesting. Did you intend the 3x3 structure from the beginning? Well, what I mean is you have three cities in the three books. You have three books, and also you basically have three connected worlds. You have Mundanus, you have the Nether, and you have Exilium. Did you intend that sort of 3x3 grid from the start?
No, because I don't see it as a three-book series. Ah. I probably shouldn't say that.
Well, if anyone goes to your website and they notice the 7 billion short stories you've written in the world, I think they'll know it's probably going to be quite extensive.
Yeah, there's more of the core story to tell, and I'm really hoping that there are enough readers in love with the split worlds for Angry Robot to commission the fourth. But the three thing, no, there was nothing. There was never anything. There was no conscious design there. I have in mind a location for the fourth novel. And I'm not going to say anything more about it because that would just be bad and wrong. But yeah, so it wasn't. No, it's just the way that it's turned out so far.
I just kept seeing threes everywhere I went reading your books. You have Maxwell and Catherine. You have the three worlds. You have three cities. You have three levels of reality. I just kept seeing the structure where there apparently is no explicit structure that way.
The joy of being a human being and seeing patterns. I love that kind of stuff. No, I mean, it wasn't a conscious thing. And I guess, you know, three is a magic number. Sorry, that always pops into my head whenever I say the number three, which is incredibly irritating. But I think it is. It's one of those really comfortable numbers. You know, it's used in political speeches all the time, the whole three thing. So maybe it's something that we're kind of geared up to see.
Yeah, it's embedded in so many things, religion and all kinds of stuff.
Mm,
you know, this number of threes. So it's almost on some lateral level, Paul, you were designed to see the number three.
Yeah, and three wishes. I mean, hell, now you're saying it, I'm thinking, well, yeah, you know, did
yeah,
I do
three
that?
Wishes.
Did I do that on purpose and I just didn't know? No, I'm not that clever. No.
Your unconscious could have been like three.
It could have been.
Talking to you over and over until you stuck a lot of threes in there.
Maybe yeah. So.
Who knows? I mean, if we are, as they say, pattern recognizing creatures, could we not also be unconsciously pattern creating creatures?
Yeah, and I'm often really quite surprised by stuff that just pops up when I'm writing a story or writing a novel or running a game that 3 months later is like, oh my God, yeah, that is so obviously the massive trigger of this whole plotline, and oh, that's the solution, or that's the thing which explains all of this, and I didn't know when I wrote it. It just seemed like an extraneous detail at the time, but it actually underpins all of this other stuff. Yeah. So yeah, that happens quite often, and certainly with the short stories, there are things which I consciously seeded in the stories, and things which were definitely unconsciously seeded that. Kind of, I revisited writing the later novels and going, oh wow, I didn't realize I needed that when I wrote that, but I so obviously do, and that's kind of fun.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly an inch. I'm sorry, Paul, did you have another?
It was just a comment. Fae Quartz, Sorcerer Quartz, Elemental Quartz. 3-3-3 again.
I know. Okay, yeah, you're right. And my unconscious clearly did not send me that memo because I'm completely shocked. Honestly, my internal administration is just appalling. I didn't receive that.
They should be sacked.
They should. I mean, honestly, half of myself I would sack immediately. But no, yeah. If only I could. I'm desperately inefficient. But never mind.
So one of the things, and it's not necessarily related to what Paul was bringing up. So, I mean, if Paul, you want to go back to something you'd mentioned earlier, if you want to bounce off this, that's fine. But I was interested in the arbiters, these individuals who kind of, they're like protectors, I guess you kind of say. They're like police forces of sorts. And Max's perspective, he is one of the arbiters. I was really curious when you describe the arbiters, give up their soul. They're like severed from it. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, it produces people who basically have to fake being quote unquote human. And he can kind of see through it. He's like, yeah, that smile you just gave me is like fake creeper smile. But I'm really interested in this idea of having that severing of the soul and almost a severing of self, a kind of detached self. So where did you kind of come up with this idea of how the arbiters become arbiters, how they go from being everyday sort of ordinary folks to being these sort of supernatural, maybe that's not quite not the right word. And could you talk a bit about how they actually function in your world?
I really wish I could remember where I came up with the idea or how that happened, and I can't. When I try and think back, all I can think of is Max being there. But I think it must have been – oh, I know, actually, now I'm thinking about it. It was part of the world design of making sure that the different power factions were balanced. Because when you have Fae who have gross magic, really powerful – scary ass magic, and you have sorcerers who have really gross scary ass magic, which works in a completely different metaphysical way, I wanted to look at the points of intersection and the way that one would police the other. And there's an entire backstory and plot explaining everything about how the split worlds came about and before the split worlds, and I mean, there's just acres and acres of stuff which will probably never even be seen in the novels. It's just all there in my head. But the Arbiters grew out of that world building because you just typed in a really funny comment. That's hugely distracting me. What was I saying? Yeah, so the Arbiters have to exist because Fae magic acts upon the soul. And so if you split the worlds and you have a treaty which outlines all of the rules and all of the things that have to be obeyed and observed by all parties involved, you need people who can arbitrate between wronged parties and who can be completely detached from the magic that the ones who are the most likely to try and fuck everyone else off with uses. They have to be protected from it, and the only way to truly protect them is to dislocate the soul. So that in terms of a metaphysical reason, that's why they exist and why they have to exist that way, because otherwise they would suck, because the Fae would do something really bad and dodgy, and they would go along and say, hello, Mr. Fae, did you just totally kidnap that person over there? And they'd go, "Ooh," you know, and do a Jedi mind trick on them, and they would suck. So they have to not have a soul. Otherwise, it would all fall apart. But their role has evolved over the years. And from that backstory, there's all kinds of stuff to do with the royal Fae, because they're a royal Fae. And then there's the kind of the standard court of the Fae, and where even the concept of royalty came from within humanity and within the Fae. And oh, there's so much I'd love to be able to tell, but I can't. But, you know, if you want to buy me a drink sometime, Paul, when I'm hopefully next at Convergence, I might be able to say some of it to you. But so that's kind of where that came from. So in terms of having Max as a character who has a dislocated soul, that's really quite interesting to write, because obviously when you write characters and when you have their kind of internal world as well, a huge proportion of that is their emotional reaction and their emotional inner life. And he has none. There is none of that. And so it was really, I remember writing the very first scene with Max where he's analyzing evidence in an apartment. He's on a case, and how I had to keep checking myself and saying, no, he would not think of it that way. He would not do it that way, because there is no emotion here. There isn't even necessarily instinct. And what is instinct and all of those kind of things. And then of course the gargoyle comes along, which houses his soul. And so there was a deliberate kind of exploration of our own kind of internal makeup of kind of like ego, id and superego, and the different parts of us that are kind of constantly in dialogue with each other and constantly warring with each other as well, where the gargoyle is kind of bringing his emotions to the table. And Max has to deal with that in his face for the first time, which obviously creates hijinks often.
Yeah, yeah. Paul, I see you put your hand up, so you want to jump in here.
Yeah, just a quick question bouncing off of that for a moment, Emma. The whole gargoyle containing Max's soul, were you inspired at all by Philip Pullman's Amber Spyglass trilogy?
Well, not consciously. I read them many years ago. I think that we're all inspired by everything we've ever read. I think, though, you know what I think inspired me more for the gargoyle was a game that I played years ago, which had a gargoyle character in it called Scree, who was voiced by Katsoulis. Andreas Katsoulis? I can't remember his first. Terrible with names.
Yeah, Jakar from Babylon 5.
Yeah, him. And can I remember what that name is? Of course I can't. Was it called Primal, the game or something? Anyway, you had a gargoyle psychic, and he was just the most amazingly wonderful thing ever. And obviously, I always wanted one. And I completely forgot about it until I was talking to my husband just a few months ago. And it was like, holy crap! My God, that must be where the gargoyle came from. And it was like, I don't know, 10 years ago or something stupid. And I think all of these things just kind of get thrown into the compost heap and come out in different ways.
Yeah, gargoyles are not common in fantasy literature. There's your gargoyle, and the only one I can think of is the Anton Strout books. Those are the only other ones I can think of as gargoyles really being used.
Yeah, I can't remember gargoyles in any other things.
There's a TV show called Gargoyles.
Is there?
Yes, but that was years ago.
It was a cartoon show. Yeah.
Oh, but you see, you know, gargoyles are, you know, another one of these things which are deep in our consciousness. And also in Oxford, there are tons of gargoyles and grotesques like everywhere. And I've always been very, very fond of them.
Yeah.
So I think that was probably an influence as well.
What is the artistic movement that gargoyles are typically associated with? Is it the Gothic?
I think so. I would not want to pretend to be any kind of expert on it. But I mean, there in Oxford, there is just rows of them on buildings. Well, grotesques mostly, which are just kind of faces rather than things with bodies, like a gargoyle has. And then once I can't actually remember thinking, oh, it'll be a gargoyle. I really wish I could. It just kind of just happened that way. And then I had to, obviously, because I'm such a nerd, I had to go and find the actual gargoyle, because all of the locations are accurate in all of the books. You can go to all of the places. And so I had to make sure that there was a place which had the right kind of gargoyle, because I wanted the gargoyle to be big, and I wanted him to be physically intimidating in the way that a soul never is. And I wanted to have that kind of weird juxtaposition that he could, you know, be a real bruiser when he's actually just a vessel for a soul. And the St. Pancras Renaissance Hotel that was recently renovated, which is the most amazing building, has got loads of them. Loads of them, more gargoyles than you could shake a drain pipe at. It's just marvelous. And they're all the right size.
Well, I was totally wrong. It has nothing to do whatsoever with the Gothic.
Oh, have you been Googling?
I just quickly looked just to see whether I was correct. And while it is associated with Catholic churches, because there are a lot of them are Catholic churches, the Gothic is fairly recent. So.
Oh, yeah. And they're much older than that, aren't they? Yeah.
And there are gargoyles that aren't like what we typically think of gargoyles. They're like lion gargoyles, and they're gargoyles that like go back all the way to like AD and like the early first few centuries. Like, yeah. So, yeah. Nothing to do with anything I said. I'm a moron.
No, you're not. Gargoyles are cool. That's all.
They are pretty cool.
It's niche knowledge. You're not a moron for not knowing something that's really quite niche.
Fair enough. It is interesting, though, when you look, because typically we have a perspective of a gargoyle, what we think a gargoyle looks like. But yet, when you look at the history of the gargoyles, they're all kinds of critters that they just stick on the sides. You know, they've got lions and goats and creepy goat-lion mixtures, and I don't know what that is, but okay. Yeah, there's just all kinds of weird stuff and faces and people, and it's kind of cool, actually.
It's great, yeah. The stuff that you see on the sides of cathedrals and things, it's just fantastic.
Makes you wonder about the people who came up with this stuff.
Well, they lived in a very scary world. My God, how terrifying. Well, you know, do you imagine you just don't understand anything and it's all monsters and demons and heaven and hell? No wonder they carved terrifying, grotesque things.
It's true.
Well, apparently they were used to, on the Catholic churches, were like used to ward off like evil spirits. Yeah, mm-hmm. The primary use was to convey the concept of evil through the form of a gargoyle, which is especially useful in sending a stark message to the common people, most of whom were illiterate. So, yeah, and they're said to scare evil spirits away from the church, which would reassure the congregants. So, I'm not...
A monster to fight other monsters.
Yeah, I'm not sure where that's in the Bible. Thou must buildeth gargoyles... to ward off Satan. Apparently that's the 11th commandment. But...
Yeah, people have been embellishing stuff for quite some time.
It is interesting the ways that religions or other kinds of institutions find ways to, in this case, assure their members that all is well or that they can offer some form of protection. Because as you say, right, they lived in a time when... I mean, they didn't know basically anything. I mean, they knew a lot. It's the 12th century is when this stuff is coming from. They knew quite a bit, but they didn't know, like, a lot of things. So, like, diseases, the fairly limited knowledge of medical stuff. So, yeah. And the ways in which they found to sort of reassure their constituents, as it were.
It's incredible how recent a lot of our medical knowledge is. Yeah. When you kind of look at it, that's something that's very much tied in with the history of London that I love, is all of the realization about the spread of disease and a guy. I don't know if I should say it because I might get the name wrong, and then obviously it exists forever on the interwebs, my terrible ignorance. But I want to say that the guy was called Jon Snow, but I don't know if that's because I'm obviously addled with Game of Thrones. But there was a chap in London who worked out how disease was kind of spread through the water supply. And there's like pubs named after him in London.
Wow.
And, you know, people who wouldn't drink the water and stuff like that. So he worked out waterborne disease. And of course, Bazalgette was just such a dude. And the whole great stink and the river being horribly, you know, polluted, and the incredible engineering. And there's all of the stuff to do with the Industrial Revolution and to do with the Elemental Court that just hasn't come out in the books yet. There's huge, huge amounts of backstory to do with Lord Iron in his various incarnations. Oh, it was Jon Snow.
Yep, yes. I found it.
I'm doing a victorious air punch here.
Awesome.
Which doesn't translate into audio very well, but yes. Yeah, Jon Snow. He was a really cool guy, and mapped it out, I think, in Covent Garden or near that area, in kind of the West End of London. So, yeah, all of this kind of stuff going on, and I live in the west of England and quite close by. In fact, I was there yesterday, is Bristol. And Bristol is a major city with major part in the history of the split worlds, but whether it'll ever come out, I don't know. I'm just
to have people buy all your books so you can write that book set in Bristol.
Yeah, there's just so much. There's so much in the background and to do with Lord Iron, which I don't know if it'll come out. I don't know.
Well, one of the things that I thought was interesting, since Paul had brought up the cities, Bath is a city I've actually been to, which is pretty cool. I've been to London too, but like, that's the big city. Everyone goes to London. So it doesn't sound as impressive to me to be like, I've been to this obscure city. Well, Bath isn't really obscure. But anyway, what is it about Bath that you found so interesting as a space to sort of explore within this sort of fantasy world you're creating?
Well, there were the two aspects. There's the architecture and how much of the architecture remains today.
Mm, yeah.
So when you walk around the city, there are entire streets which still look as they, you know, very close to the way they would look at the time when they were built. Whereas if you go to London, there are huge, huge amounts of were destroyed in the Blitz. And in fact, another trilogy that I wrote before this one was very much about London and its memories of itself, and how you can walk down a street in London and you can have a leaning original Tudor building next to a 1960s concrete monstrosity just because of where a bomb happened to fall during the Blitz. And so it's much of a kind of a architectural mosaic in London, whereas in Bath there are huge portions of it which are still the same. So there was that aspect, and that played into the way that the people who live in nether society in turn control humanity. And so there was the kind of the politics and the influence that they have on the real world. So like hierarchies of puppetry and control, and why Bath still looks the way it does. And the other aspect that I've always found interesting about Bath was the whole Beau Nash phenomenon, where in its heyday, that he invented kind of social rules which transcended class. And so the social season in Bath kind of exploded and was the most amazing thing ever, because he created rules like, you know, don't take a sword to a ball. You know, really basic stuff that you'd think that polite people wouldn't. But yeah, he invented a very strict set of social rules which made Bath hugely successful and kind of drew people from London for the season to go there and dance and do all of the dances and stuff like that. And I loved that aspect of its history and thought, you know, that's a pretty remarkable person. I reckon he wasn't just a normal person. And that kind of, you know, inspired whole other tracts of ideas and inspired the master of ceremonies in the books.
Oh, fantastic. So, Paul, go ahead and ask your question. I'm going to jump in after you.
Yeah, I want to jump from Bath to London for a moment. It seems in recent years, Emma, that London's been a hot setting for urban fantasy of various stripes. You have your works, you have Paul Cornell, you have Ben Aaronovitch, you have John Lambshead.
Yeah, Tom Pollock. Yeah.
Why do you think suddenly London is the urban fantasy place to set your novels in?
London has got so many layers of history and so many quirks and so many weirdnesses. And if you spend time there, I think you have to actually work pretty hard not to write an urban fantasy about London. because it's made for it. There are very few places that stimulate me more than London does. And if I'm ever at a kind of a low ebb creatively, just a day trip to London and just walking around just makes me fizz. There's just so much going on there, such variety of people side by side, whether it's social and social economic class. You know, you have people destitute and begging on a street where you have other people walking past in shoes that cost more than I could earn in 10 years. It's just the strangest place. And with the Blitz and the effect of the war on the architecture, and also as far back as like the Great Fire in 1666, I think it is, which just kind of burnt down huge areas of the city, so that we suddenly have these kind of wide avenues and Wren's influence on the city, which create very, very different places. And then suddenly you walk from one of those streets into a place that wasn't burnt down in the Great Fire of London, and you go back into this kind of tight medieval maze of streets. That kind of thing just it fucks with your brain. And you know, people write urban fantasy as a result, direct result, I think, is my theory.
Well, in a way, and this kind of goes to the thing I was going to jump on after Paul anyway, that's all kind of related. There's something about London, may be a specific. I mean, I haven't been at all places in England yet, because there's a lot of places. But there is something about the way in which a city like London has almost like representations or figments of worlds that used to exist. So when we're talking about places that have burned down, and there've been new things that have built on top of it, and on this constant merging all of these different times, you know, because we're talking, like, you know, you said it was
1666.
So that's hundreds of years before the Blitz.
Yeah,
right? And then more stuff gets burned down.
And you can still see the effect of each of those stages, and it's all there.
Yeah, and there's almost a kind of a I don't know if that was something you had thought was a metaphorical, the way in which the worlds you've created, these split worlds, are almost metaphors for the way in which the cities, in London in particular, has been fragmented, so that you have worlds upon worlds almost layered on top, like worlds as in histories, the points in history that are so distinct that have now been sort of layered on top of the city itself.
I guess so. Again, that wouldn't have been a conscious thing. I mean, certainly with Oxford and book three, and the university there and how that intersects with the split worlds, I did draw upon quite a lot of experiences of feeling kind of separated from society, separated from the rest of England, separated from my own family in many ways, and just a really odd experiences I had there. I think that's true. I mean, funny enough, I explore the history of London significantly less. I mean, it's in the background in book two. I mean, the decision to put the Nether Court in Somerset House is very much rooted in history, and where it's subsequently moved to in book three is very much rooted in where our history merges with that of those in Nether society. I mean, Somerset House is not one of the most beautiful places in London. I was spoilt for choice. You know, which beautiful building would the Nether Court of Londinium choose to have as its seat of office? And yet I settled on Somerset House because of the reason it was created in the real world, when it was built at the peak of empire, and they wanted to have a location to run the forces from, the navy in particular. They wanted to have something which intimidated and dominated people in the local area and have a distinct psychological effect on people when they walked into it. I went on this really fascinating tour of it, and they were talking about the very strict architectural brief that it couldn't be embellished too much. But there were certain concentrated areas of embellishment, this very grand statue with this like cornucopia to express the plenty of the British Empire. And elsewhere, it's very stark and very stern. And I loved the kind of the psychological impact of the building. And I wanted to reflect on how out of touch Nether society is. They haven't got a fucking clue that Britain is nothing now. And they still think, so many of them still think, that it's still an empire. And, you know, they're still in the days where the sun wouldn't go down on the British without asking permission first. It's just not like that anymore, to quote Stephen Fry, who I adore. And that there was another statement in choosing that location, that it was at the pinnacle of empire. They still think they're at the pinnacle of empire, and they're obviously not. And playing with the idea of some people in England as well still thinking that we're more than we are now.
Well, and there is, and I know that I've heard discussions among people who sort of are nostalgic for the empire. That's, they know it doesn't exist anymore, but they like look back and go, ah, when we were an empire, it was so wonderful.
Yeah, we were complete fucks, and I think that's what I just like to look at, just overlook. We did the most horrific things on a global level for hundreds of years. I mean, honestly, I'm embarrassed and ashamed when I think about my cultural history in many respects. But I think that the thing that people, and certainly, you know, in the circles that I move in and my own self, what I kind of miss is good manners and, you know, being polite and genteel. That's the kind of thing that I miss, you know, being pleasant to each other on a daily basis. And at the same time, a hatred of that and a hatred of those strict social rules, and they are uncomfortable within me, and they're uncomfortable, and they're deliberately uncomfortable within the split worlds, because there is a love of all of that and the manners and the politeness, but also the way that it controlled people and controlled society, I have a deep loathing for. I think it's quite a complex relationship we have with our own past, our idea of our past and the future. But I mean, so many times I'll hear the news and think that we are a very tiny island, and the last time that we were, you know, a proper world power was really some time ago. Mm-hmm. And there are some people who just don't seem to have realized that yet.
Well, and, yeah. I mean, Paul and I live in a country that doesn't want to admit it has an empire, but it technically has a version, and still seems determined to have one, and isn't sure how not to do that and still be an influence in the world.
Yeah, and it's, I think it's very difficult, and that's one of the things I'd love to have the opportunity to explore more of the global split worlds, because there's politics in America, which has an influence on the novels. Nobody knows about that yet.
Yeah.
But there is a character from America that has her own plot and her own backstory that may or may, I hope, will come out. Because I want to kind of explore the relationship and the kind of the hangover of the past in relation to the UK and America. Because there are lots of people knocking around in the split worlds who still think it's the colonies. You know, if you actually dragged them into Mundanus for a day and sat them in front of the news after they got over the shock of what a television is, they would just be, you know, they would not understand. They would not understand how this happened. Mm. So, yeah.
That would be something I'd be very interested in, because to see how people who aren't American and don't live in America actually perceive our history. Because you come from the UK is different. Like, let's not make it like you're an alien world. But, like, there are different cultural histories, and your perspective is going to influence how you view what happens in the U.S. history. And that perspective, I think, is very valuable to see how other people view things, because it gives you a different perspective on yourself. So, you know, because otherwise I could just talk to Americans all day and, well, we're crazy. So there's some craziness going on. But, like, you know, Paul and I could talk about America all day. Paul and I probably don't disagree on all that much, and we probably have roughly similar perspectives with some variations. But getting that alternate perspective is, I think, very valuable.
Yeah, it's easier to see things if you can step away from it slightly. Even if it's just from England to the United States, you get to, you can see just how screwed up things are. Because we're in the hothouse and we're not quite seeing just how mutated the plants are all around us.
I was going to say the other thing as well, of course, is that you can only consume yourself through your own media, and you know my feelings about the media. Just as we can only consume ourselves by the British media, apart from our own day-to-day experience, which doesn't extend much further than our homes and our places of work. So I think that's something which is a major factor in our kind of national self-perceptions as well. But anyway.
Which is why I listen to a lot of foreign news.
Mm.
So BBC's pretty good for that.
Yeah, I use the BBC as well as a nice bit of Pluralix.
No. Mm. And Al Jazeera. I'll go to Al Jazeera, which probably by 50% of Americans makes me an evil Nazi monkey. I don't know what that makes.
Evil Nazi, communist, fascistic, socialist.
Pinko.
Yeah.
Trotskyite,
Hitlerite. Yeah.
Mussolini. Let's just start, like, throwing out random names. Pol Pot. Mao. Random names of people nobody likes.
Bernard. Oh, no. That's
Justin Bieber. There we go.
Poor lad.
Bieberism.
Bless him.
All right, Paul, I've given you the last serious question, so you had your hand up, so jump for it.
Yep. Last serious question, actually tying in with some of the stuff we actually were talking about, Emma. There you do have the strand of feminism and women trying to get empowered in the split worlds, especially as Catherine's learning about her past and how she's trying to untangle that and reclaim that. The other strand, as you were mentioning before, is politics. And there's politics shot through the split worlds from ground up, the feuding families, the feuding fave patrons. Why politics? Why, I mean, there's a lot of authors who wouldn't touch politics or political games or political machinations and conflicts with a 10-foot pole, but you dive straight into it without reservation. Why do you think that is?
Oh, because I'm a role player. No, seriously.
That's a good answer.
Seriously, I had many happy years playing in large-scale games of kind of around 70 players or so with different power factions and a lot of politicking. and running games, writing worlds, writing games to support that structure of, it was our role-playing game society, of the society game. You had to have politics to underpin a game that would run for several months at a time for 70 odd people. And I think that there was a bit of my brain that was wired from that. And also Shogun, it's one of my favorite books. Mm. And Shogun is, you know, for me, arguably like the perfect novel that makes me happy, even though it isn't even SFF. The mixture of proper heroic kind of adventure coupled with complex political stuff going on all the time, and yet it's still being incredibly tense and incredibly exciting. That is like the pinnacle I would, you know, want to aspire to one day, that I'll never come close to. Yeah, by James Clavell.
Okay.
And I love that book. So the politics for me in the Split Worlds, it seems an impossibility to have a world as large as the Split Worlds is, across layers of society, across geographical locations, without politics. For me, they are entirely intertwined. You can't have people who have power and things that they want to defend without them trying to shaft each other. It's human nature, sadly. And, you know, they're all just trying to screw each other over. And there are also deeper metaphysical reasons for some of the conflicts. Again, some of the stuff that may never come out in the novels, but there are really deep, deep parts of the backstory which have effectively created fault lines, I guess, in history. And fault lines mean conflict, and conflict means politics.
Very good answer. Very good. Okay, so why don't we jump to our sort of silly questions, our questions 5. So you don't have to think about these too much, just kind of the quick questions. So okay. don't stress about, like, if you get the wrong answer or anything. That's not a big deal. They're just silly. So, okay. Oh, and Paul's going to add one on, so now it's going to be question 6. So,
okay.
All right, so question number 1, would you rather live in Mundanus, the Nether, or Exilium?
Oh, my goodness. I would want to live in the Nether, but with a tie to Mundanus. No, I want to live in Mundanus, but know about the Nether. Oh, I don't know. They are all awful in their own way. I want to live in all of them, and I get to because I'm the author.
Okay, fine. All right,
That was a rubbish answer, sorry.
It's fine. All right, so number 2, would you rather be an arbiter or a member of one of the Fae families?
Oh, howdy. Oh, they're both really awful. do you mean as in one of the, like, the Nether Society families, like Kathy and...
Yeah, yeah.
Well, oh, my God, that would be a living hell for me. I'd rather be an arbiter.
There you go. Awesome. Number 3, which one city do you think is the most likely to house the supernatural, as in to really have real supernatural things in it, if it were real?
Oxford or London, maybe.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah, I think maybe Oxford.
Fair enough. All right, number 4, this is actually legitimately silly. Which food do you think would make a fairy sick?
Mushrooms. No, that's me. Sorry, no, that's me. I don't know. What would make a fairy sick? Anything processed, I would imagine. You know, McDonald's would definitely be out.
Oh, okay. American cheese food.
Yeah.
Fair enough. All right, number 5. If you were on a deserted island, this is tough, which one book would you like to have with you?
Oh, that is really tough. Is it only one?
Yes.
Only one book?
Only one.
I have a deep, deep love of American Gods, but I think it might have to be Shogun.
All right.
I love that book.
I'm going to have to read it now, because you keep talking it up, and I have it on my shelf.
Yes, you must read it.
You must read it. All right, Paul, your last question.
Yep. Okay, Emma, you're going to get a boon. You can't choose the boon, but you can choose the boon is either going to come from Lord Poppy, Lord Iris, or Lord Iron. Who do you choose?
Iron. because he's the only bastard that could protect me from the Fae. There is no way I would go anywhere near Poppy and Iris. Oh, and I don't know if you've, I don't know if you agree with me, but don't you think that Tom Hiddleston would make the best ever Lord Poppy?
Oh, yes. So.
Oh, my God.
Film yeah. that movie, people.
I know. I was watching The Avengers again last night and, you know, ogling Loki as you do. And I was thinking, my God, he is just, he is Lord Poppy.
Have you seen Tom Hiddleston doing Sesame Street with Cookie Monster?
I have. It made me very, very happy.
It was awesome.
I've got such a raging crush on him. I've got such a crush on so many people. But yeah, he's wonderful. But no, I wouldn't go anywhere near Poppy and Iris. I know how awful they are.
You created them.
Yeah, really. And you know, Iris hasn't even got started yet. And no. Oh, Lord Iron.
That's probably the safest answer. I kind of figured.
Fair enough. Well, all right. So I'll make sure there are links to your website and your Twitter. And you do have a podcast that you do, which you've mentioned before. But why don't you take a minute to just mention it again so people who are listening can go check it out?
Oh, yes. I have a podcast which is entirely unrelated to the Split Worlds. And it's called Tea and Jeopardy. And every episode is in a secret tea lair in a different location. And I have a guest. And we have tea and cake, and then there's mild peril, which there should always be after tea and cake. It's very lighthearted, it's very silly. It's kind of a mixture of interviewing mostly authors and other creatives, and silly audio drama, very lighthearted.
That's adorable.
It's, well, very silly.
Perfect. So I will make sure that everybody knows where to go to check out your books, and make sure to go to Angry Robot and buy the books. Millions of them.
Yes, that would be splendid. Yes, that would be lovely.
Yeah. If you can afford it, buy millions. At the very least, buy one copy of each. Between Two Thorns is the first book. And
Any Other Name is the second. And then All's Fair finishes it up. Just as a plug, I own both paperback, ebook, and audiobooks of the books. I guess that calls me a fan.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That makes you a
not only a fan, but a splendid individual, sir. Thank you.
No.
I appreciate that greatly.
And even though I had the ebooks, because I'm a podcasty person, I did buy the first book at Worldcon so I could have Emma sign it. So I have a signed copy.
They're very pretty. They're very, very pretty. They're eminently strokeable.
They do have very nice covers, and they look very nice. So
yeah, and I don't think they have it on the US versions, but on the UK editions, the flowers and some of the details are picked out in spot UV, so they're kind of shiny against a matte background for the rest of the thing. And I just, even now, I am stroking them. They're just. I know, it's terrible. It's an affliction. I know somebody who licks books, though, and it's not as bad as licking books.
No,
I only stroke them.
That's a little strange.
Yeah.
I sniff books.
Yeah, sniff them as well. But, okay. You know, Spot UV isn't, you know, doesn't really have a scent. It's a tactile thing. But, yeah.
Maybe that person who licks books is hoping one day they create books that taste like something just for him.
Yeah, but maybe not based on the contents, because. Ooh.
I hope not.
No, that would be. Oh no, I'm thinking of so many terrible things. 50 Shades of Awful, but never mind.
That'd be blood.
Yes, blood and horrors. With, you know, no one would taste a horror book.
Sweat and skin and just weirdness.
Ew. Yeah. I think mine might taste of Parma violets or rose petals or something like that. They wouldn't be too bad. And tea and cake. There's a huge amount of tea and cake in these books, so that is exactly what they would taste of.
And cake is good.
Cake is good.
It's delicious. Well, on that note, we're gonna close out. So thank you, Emma, for coming on for the third time, and to talk about your work. It was really wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Cool. And thanks, Paul, for, you know, being my co-host today.
It was a delight. I love Emma's work.
Excellent. So everybody go check it out. Check out the links in the show notes. Go buy the books. And we will see you next time with whatever is the next episode.
Bye. Good night, everyone.
Yay!
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
skiffyandfanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@skiffyandfanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
skiffyandfanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.